5 in Denver. Bucks and Bulls are both off tonight. NHL, the Blackhawks lost to the New York Rangers 4-3. They're off tonight. NFL playoffs, the conference championships on Sunday. The LA Rams meet the New Orleans Saints for the NFC title at 2:40. And the Kansas City Chiefs meet New England for the AFC title at 5:40. Now, the detailed forecast from the National Weather Service. Today, mostly cloudy and seasonal through the day. An inch of snow this afternoon, a high of 29. Tonight, a winter storm warning up at 6 o'clock. 4 to 7 inches of snow with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Overnight low 25. Saturday, more light snow and blowing snow. Another 1 to 2 inches of accumulation. A high of 26 with winds up to 25 miles per hour. Saturday night, another 2 inches of lake effect snow likely. So total storm accumulation, depending on where you live, 7 to 12 inches. This morning is 25 degrees in Racine, now 26 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience, time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Are you a workaholic, or do you know someone? Is somebody close to you perhaps a workaholic? It seems to be something that is with us quite a lot, and sometimes out of a certain amount of necessity in this era of corporate cutbacks, where many, many people are called upon to do more and more things, where sometimes somebody is let go and their workload passes on to somebody else. Sometimes we find ourselves up to our eyeballs in work, whether we want it to be or not. But then there are those cases in which people will sometimes gravitate to their work and cling to it, bring it along with them wherever they go, and in whatever they are doing, they are still, in a sense, working, never leaving their work behind at all. That actually was the story of my morning show guest, Brian E. Robinson, who is a licensed psychotherapist and professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, now making his home in beautiful Asheville, North Carolina. He can point to his own life and to periods of time in which he was very much a workaholic, and to an extent that caused great detriment to him professionally and personally. And he has taken the expertise he has as a psychotherapist, combined it with this personal experience and struggle as a workaholic, to write a new book called #Chill, Turn Off Your Job and Turn On Your Life, in which he very thoughtfully explores this reality as it has played out for him and played out for a lot of other people, and spelled out lots and lots of tangible ways in which we can try to mitigate this tendency to be too much wrapped up in our work around the clock and all year round. And as a matter of fact, the framework of his book is around the 12 months of the year, to give us sort of different seasons to think about this in different ways. It's a very thought-provoking book indeed, published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins, again called #Chill. And Dr. Brian E. Robinson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think it's important for us to give you a chance to really tell your own story, because you offer it up very forthrightly right at the outset of your book. And I appreciate sort of your disarming candor with which you admit to the extent to which this has been a very, very serious issue for you personally. And one of the most interesting things about your story is that some of these tendencies were there a long, long time ago, way back to your childhood. Explain that, and explain the circumstances of your childhood, which probably exacerbated that situation or made it even more likely for you to show these tendencies so early.
Right. Well, this is not unusual. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. We hear that word a lot. My father was an alcoholic. And one of the things that I intuitively did in order to cope with the ups and downs, never knowing what was going to happen next, was to latch on to schoolwork, homework, taking care of my little sister, and just doing as much as I could do that I felt like I could control. It gave me a false sense of control. I even wrote. I started writing when I was 7 years old, making up these little stories, simply to get my characters in trouble and get them out of trouble. So it made me feel like I had some control over this unwieldy life. And as I say in the book at the beginning, when I was in high school, I wrote the church Christmas play. I directed it. I built the sets. I played one of the lead role of Joseph. I was doing everything, and everybody thought, this kid is just great. He's Superman. They didn't understand that underneath that, there was pain and anxiety and difficulty, because on the surface, a lot of us who were exceptional and who were achieving and getting accolades and fat paychecks, underneath that, many of us are miserable and unhappy, and we're doing it to try to medicate those deeper feelings. Now, luckily for me, I found out through therapy, and then that led me into Workaholics Anonymous and then into mindful meditation, which has really changed my life. Lucky for me, I found a path out of that. So today, my life is, I look forward to weekends with nothing to do. It's great. That used to terrify me, but now I love the quiet times, the idle moments. I meditate at least 5 minutes a day or more. So I've learned to put the brakes on. Unfortunately, there are many people today who are not even really workaholics and probably not as extreme as I was, who are, though, mimicking that same style, that same profile of hurrying and rushing and burning out and trying to get everything done and never having time for themselves and never having time for their kids or their spouse. There's always time between sunrise and sunset. We all have 5 minutes, but many people think they don't. And the book is a hashtag chill is about taking a breath, stepping back, and looking at your life through a bird's eye view, and you start to realize everybody has 5 minutes somewhere. And here's the thing. 5 minutes doesn't sound like a lot of time, but the reason I talk about 5 minutes is because when I suggest that folks eat better, relax, exercise, their hands go up and they say, I don't have time for all that. I'm too busy. I've got too much to do. But the truth is you do have 5 minutes. So if you take 5 minutes a day, I meditate. I focus on my breath. And when I do that, my thinking mind the alarm goes off. And for 5 minutes, my alarm is off. My brakes are on. And it sends a message to my brain and my nervous system that, you know what, all is well. And if we don't do that, there's going to come a point where if you drive a car 90 miles an hour and you don't put brakes on, you know what's going to happen. If we keep pushing our bodies like that and our minds, we're going to burn out. And that's why so many people today are burning out and having so many physical illnesses that result from not taking time out from the rat race.
Right. You say in your introduction, as you kind of spell some of this out, that at one point my life was crumbling under my feet and I couldn't do anything about it. Can
Right.
you take us into that reality? I mean, how did that play out for you when this was at its most serious? Well, in what way was your life crumbling beneath your very feet?
Well, my, a lot of people don't understand this, but when you're a true dyed-in-the-wool workaholic, you have the same symptoms as alcoholics. You have denial, which I was in. I didn't know what was happening. I had no clue. I didn't see the water I was swimming in. I was binging on work. I was doing hundreds of things at one. I was taking on more and more and more. Nothing was ever enough. Just like the alcoholic who has to keep drinking. I went through depression and withdrawal, just like alcoholics do. And I even hid my work. I sneaked it around, just like an alcoholic sneaking a drink, which sounds strange when I even say it now, because I was sick. I was drowning, as you said before. I was up to my eyeballs in work. And here's the deal. I was at the university. I was getting all kinds of accolades. I was getting pats on the back. I was getting fat paychecks. So everybody around me was rewarding me for it when my marriage was falling apart. And so I blamed my spouse for not supporting me. But I didn't realize what was going on and how it was affecting me so deeply. I was also having physical illnesses. I was having gastrointestinal problems. Now, I want to be real clear that this book is for everybody. My situation is on the outer part of the scale. I was on the extreme end. There are other people who are on different places, and there are different degrees of this. And I want to make sure that everybody understands that if you're caught up in doing and you don't have time for yourself or for the people you love, you've got a problem. And this book helps you see it, number one, and see life differently and experience it differently. And it gives you the micro chillers, we call them, 3 to 5 minute daily things you can do, some you can even do while you're driving your car, that will help you get back into that sweet spot that I call chill.
Hmm. I would love to have you just speak for a moment about the difference that your spouse has made in your life in helping you to come to grips with this facet of who you are. The book is dedicated to him, and clearly from some of the things you say, he has been a significant part of why you have been able to step back from some of this.
That's true. Early on, when you're in the throes of work addiction, and somebody says to you, please spend time with me, or let's go on a trip, what I did is I blamed him for interrupting my concentration or getting in the way of my book I was working on or the community project that I was doing, whatever it was. He became the bad guy because I wasn't able to see what I was doing. I was in such denial, and people were rewarding me. Looking back, he was much healthier than me, growing orchids, spending time with neighbors, hanging out in the yard, having pets, and I was locked up in my basement like I was in a cave, just plugging away, sweat pouring from my brow. Now, I see how he was my teacher, and I think this is true of a lot of us. We don't realize the people who seem to be aggravating or annoying us or bringing us a different message from the way we're seeing something are our teachers. And if we really look with curiosity instead of judgment, we can learn from these people. I often wonder what would have happened if I had not had him in my life, if someone would have been there to help me get through this.
We're speaking with Brian E. Robinson about his book called Hashtag Chill, Turn Off Your Job and Turn On Your Life. So the book is laid out in an intriguing framework with the various months of the year and various facets within kind of the larger topic. Talk for a moment about why you thought this framework made sense and what you think is most valuable about shaping the book in this way.
Well, as you say, there are 12 chapters, and each month corresponds to the month of the year, and so there's a theme. I'll use April as an example. April is named after the word apres, which means to open, and in the Northern Hemisphere, it's the time of year when spring awakens, baby birds hatch, flowers bloom, and so along with that, the theme is open awareness. I think that's the name of the chapter. I really don't remember, to tell you the truth, but the theme is opening up from within us and being more open to looking at how we're living our lives. The other thing that goes with this, and I'm not sure, Greg, if you pick this up. Some people do and some people don't. But each chapter corresponds with one of the 12 steps of Workaholics Anonymous.
I did not pick up on that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I did a communion with the month of the year plus the 12 steps. And that the fourth step is about taking a fearless inventory of ourselves and looking within, which requires a certain openness and objectivity in order to do it. So in each chapter, the very last reading is one of the 12 steps. So you have that. And then at the end of the book, there are 366 chillers. They're micro-chillers. And they're trending right now in Barnes & Noble for the month of January. There's one liner for each day of the month in January. And then February, there's one for each day of the year. And they're just simple little things. I'll read the one for today here. Let's see what it is. Today's January. Well, I'm not sure when this airs, but today says, I overcome workplace obstacles by pinpointing the opportunities hidden in difficulties. And there's one of the themes of the book is to look at most of us when we approach a difficulty, it becomes a problem. And the book helps you widen your lens so that you can flip that around and say, okay, what's the opportunity here? How can I make this work for me? How can I turn it into a positive? And that empowers us when we're able to look at a difficult situation in a different way. And that's really what that means.
Right. It really appreciated this part of the book at the very end, 366 chillers. And for instance, one of the items for January that really jumped out at me that would be helpful to me and is actually something I've already kind of implemented on myself for myself, but it looks good to see you reinforcing the importance of it, is January 14th. I break the habit of scheduling myself too tightly. And for me, part of my work life is as a voice teacher at a local college, and my propensity for many, many years was to pack the lessons together as tightly as I could, and then I would be done a little earlier and I could get home. But that would make the day itself so much more difficult than if I didn't lay into the schedule little breaks of even 15 minutes that would just be breathing room. And
absolutely.
So
that's so important. I call those time cushions. It's something I've learned to do, too. I used to not even have that concept. I would go from one appointment to the next, and sometimes I would be 10 miles away from the next appointment and have them scheduled back-to-back. It was just ridiculous. And, of course, trying to get there, my heart would start racing. I would be stressed and didn't even understand why. But when you put those, as you say, those time cushions in between, you're more chill and your mind is clearer as well, and you're going to do a better job at what you're doing. That's the paradox. A lot of people think if they can hurry and rush and do more things and multitask, they're going to get more done. What we know from the research that not going to get as much done, and it's not going to be as good of a quality. The slower we approach it, the better the outcome and the more effective we are.
Absolutely. I want to, first let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Dr. Brian Robinson about his book, #Chill, Turn Off Your Job and Turn On Your Life. And I think it would be really interesting to explore, since we're talking in the month of January as we record this, to talk about several of the really great points that are made in that chapter, which is titled "Fresh Starts." One of the interesting points made here is involving what you call constructing your scaffolding. And you write, yeah. Your workaholic habits are like an old building that needs renovating to withstand future wear and tear. As you conduct the repair work, you need temporary scaffolding, a wood plank to stand on and metal poles to lean on until your foundation is ready. Explain what you're getting at there, this notion of personal scaffolding, and how this is really important in order to make maybe more comprehensive and deep-seated changes in your approach to all this.
Well, many people reading this book are probably going to want to achieve this yesterday, and it's really about fresh starts and one step at a time and not rushing and hurrying through it like we do our jobs. So it's really about the foundation is about stepping back and maybe going to a Workaholics Anonymous meeting online or having a support group or many people this time of year have New Year's resolutions. I have New Year's intentions, and if I were working on my scaffolding, I'll tell you what my intention is for the new year is to forgive everybody who gets in my way. Now, that's not easy. That's a tall order for myself because I'm human like everybody listening. I haven't arrived anywhere. I practice everything in this book, and I try to become better at it, but I haven't. I'm not a perfectionist, and I haven't perfected it. So if someone were to see me in traffic banging the steering wheel, I hope that doesn't happen, but I can't promise it won't. I have reactivity like everybody else. But my part of my foundation is every day I watch when someone or something gets in my way, how do I respond? Do I act or react? And I'm trying to act. And when I say act, I mean I'm trying to come from my center. That's the main focus for the rest of this year. An example would be if my neighbor's weed eater awakens me from sleep, what do I do? If someone steps in front of me at the grocery store, in the grocery store line, what do I do? If someone cuts me off in traffic, if the baby crying behind me on the airplane it is inconsolable. These things are called life, and they happen all the time. Nature, life throws us curveballs. So my job is not to have life accommodate me. My job is to accommodate life. And so the more conscious we are when we set these small goals, then it helps us focus on it, and it helps us realize in the moment what we're doing and how we can change that. Mm-hmm. So I think at the beginning of the book, it's important for everybody just to take a baby step. Don't go too far, but something very simple that you can do to set your foundation. And the book, as you go through the 12 months, it builds on the foundation as you go through.
Right. I appreciate some of the very basic notions here that are so important, like embrace your flaws. And evidently, one of your concerns is that when somebody is a workaholic, one of the things they are trying to do is flee their flaws or escape their flaws or escape
exactly.
Having to think about their flaws or
right.
To cover over their flaws by being so good at what they do with their work.
Mm.
And
yeah.
And so very, very much at the outset, being more comfortable, being more honest and accepting of our own flaws can make a real difference here.
Right. And perfectionism is one of the profiles of the workaholic is I have to be perfect at what I do. I can't be human. I can't fail. I can't forget. I can't make a mistake, which is not possible, and it's inhuman. So it creates the stress and the anxiety and the burnout. The whole idea of accepting our flaws is about letting ourselves be human. It's like I said a few minutes ago, I'm not going to promise that I'm not going to react if someone cuts me off in traffic, because that would be unrealistic. However, it's a goal that I have to not react. But if I do, I'm not going to beat myself up. I'm gonna try again. I'm going to get back in the saddle. What we know is when we make a mistake or forget or we fall short of our goals, many people beat themselves up. They eviscerate themselves, which makes them walk away from the goal instead of stay in the game. And you can name anybody in any arena that we all know, like Meryl Streep, Michael Jordan, Billie Jean King, Tiger Woods. Every one of them has failed or made a mistake or forgotten. They didn't get where they are strictly on their talents, although they're all talented. They have a mindset so that when they fail or they lose, they get back in the saddle. They don't beat themselves up and put themselves down, because what that does, it makes you turn away and walk away from the goal. They wipe the sweat off their brow with that towel they want to throw in. They get back in the game, and that's why they're successful.
Do you have time for me to ask you a couple more questions?
Sure.
Great. Again, we're talking with Brian Robinson about his book, Hashtag Chill, Turn Off Your Job and Turn On Your Life. One line that really leapt out at me, again, from this first chapter of January Fresh Starts, you say, work addiction has been called this century's cocaine. Work weeks of 60, 80, even 100 hours are commonplace in major law firms and corporations. One of the things that is interesting about that is that it reminds us that in some cases, people are workaholics very much sort of out of themselves. I mean, out of a drive that is within them, and they are doing things or going to lengths that nobody is insisting that they do. It is to satisfy something within them. And in many cases, of course, maybe most cases, it's an unhealthy way of satisfying an unhealthy desire that one might have. And then there are other circumstances in which those kind of back-breaking hours are expected of one's superiors and colleagues, and it is part of the culture. So it seems to me that we're really talking about a couple of different things there, and not that what your book offers isn't helpful to both, but it seems to me that there is a differentiation that is worth acknowledging. Do you see a divide there between, in a sense, two different kind of workaholics? And is maybe one of those more of the workaholic paradigm and the other is somebody working way too much, but not necessarily because they're a workaholic?
Right. That's a really good question. A dyed-in-the-wool workaholic, a true workaholic, is driven. And that's coming from within them. It's their response. It's something they bring to the job. We can't really blame the ABC store for alcoholics, for creating alcoholism. And we can't blame the workplace for creating workaholism, although it certainly does set it up and enable it, which we can talk about. But if I'm a workaholic, and certainly in my situation, it was self-imposed. And many of us have this voice inside in our echo chamber that says, you have to be better. You have to do better. I think part of mine was because of growing up in an alcoholic family and my dad not achieving what he could have. He was an inventor and he was brilliant. But his alcoholism caused him to have a short-lived life. I think on some level I was trying to extend that for him and to make up for what he wasn't able to achieve. That came to me later. That insight came to me later in my life. But whatever the case, I was pushing myself over the cliff, and that was coming from inside me, not from the university where I was teaching. That was all clearly I was going way over the line. So, but there are people who are not really workaholics who end up in jobs, as you well said, where people are being laid off or people are being fired, or it's happening right here in this city that I live in. There's a big hospital that's coming in, and a lot of people are having to assume basically second jobs or doing two jobs because of the changes that are being made, and it's creating a lot of stress. Those are not necessarily people who want to work all the time. Many of these people want to have more balance and did have more balance and are in the habit of spending time with their families and taking good care of themselves. So when that happens, that's a different kind of decision that we have to make. Workaholics don't really consider leaving their jobs or finding something else so they can be healthier unless they get into recovery. That's not even something that enters their mind. But if you're not a workaholic and you value being with your family and being part of your children's lives and having balance for yourself, then you're not going to tolerate that for a long period of time. So they are two separate things, but when you look at on the surface, they can look very similar.
Hmm. One of the things you talk about at this point in talking about work addiction as this century's cocaine is that we're talking about people who are working enormous number of hours and achieving a work high. Highs run a cycle of adrenaline-charged binge working. And this isn't the only place in the book that you talk about the physiology that is behind this. What is, for instance, going on in our nervous system? Describe in more detail what is going on inside the body physically when someone is engaged in this cycle, whether willingly or not.
Well, one of the things that happens, if I have a deadline, I'm a workaholic and I have a deadline, it's going to create anxiety. So on a mental level, I'm aware of the anxiety, but on a physiological level, my body is perceiving my not getting to the deadline as a threat. So Mother Nature wired us to respond to threats with reactivity and with a chemical reaction. So if I'm afraid I'm not going to meet the deadline, my body is going to secrete adrenaline and cortisol and other deadly chemicals to get me to the deadline because Mother Nature wants us to survive. The problem with that is over time, if I continue down that path, it's going to clog my arteries. I'm going to be at high risk for heart attack, gastrointestinal problems. It's going to affect my brain, the quality of my brain, because what we know is people who live that way, the hippocampus starts to shrink, and it affects your clarity, it affects your decision-making, it affects your creativity, all in a negative way. It affects your immune system in a negative way. So our body responds to our mind. The cells of our body, think of it this way, the cells of our body are in the wings listening all the time. And if I say, holy shit, I'm not going to make that deadline, the cells of my body dump these chemicals in my bloodstream to help me get there. And I might make the deadline, but this is why we call them deadlines. At some point, it's going to get me. It's going to kill me if I don't change that behavior. This is why in Japan, they have a term called karoshi. Karoshi, we don't even have that word in our English language. Karoshi means death from overwork. Because men in their 40s, specifically men, we're seeing it more with women now, drop dead at their desks from working around the clock 24/7. It happens here, too. We just don't, we'll say he had a heart attack or stroke, but we don't have a name that related to work. But many people drop dead every day because they're overworking and it's killing them because of the physiological damage that they're doing to their bodies and their minds.
Wow. It's very intriguing to read some of the suggestions that you have for people who find themselves caught in this cycle. And not all of them are quite as direct as, for instance, trying to build some cushion into your schedule, if you have control of your own schedule to that extent, to make that possible, and other matters that are very directly related. There are others that, in a sense, go sort of a level deeper to matters that are not nearly so obvious, and I think are so interesting. For instance, again in this first chapter of Fresh Starts, you talk about the importance of embracing maybe. I'd never stop to think about how that is probably a concept that is maybe alien or very distasteful to the typical workaholic that wants everything laid out and everything to unfold according to the plan. Explain how someone who is a workaholic can go about embracing maybe, and what a difference that could conceivably make in their life.
Well, workaholics are terrified of unpredictability and uncertainty. Because as you just said, if you're a workaholic, you want to know what the deal is. You want to know how you're going to get there. All your energies are focused on that. Your body aligns itself as if there's a threat, and that's how the body responds. But the problem is, it's not really a problem, but it becomes a problem. Life is not certain. Life does not come to us with predictability. By its very nature, life is going to throw us curveballs. Life is going to be unpredictable. We don't know what's around the corner. Nobody knows. So, but workaholics can't deal with that. They have to know. So the medicine, the antidote for this is, and you're right, it does take you deeper. Here's an example of how we start off with that foundation. And as you build the foundation, there are these other kinds of things that help you take a reframe on how you're looking at life. So what if instead of me having to feel like I can control everything, which I can't, is to let that go and just think about maybe. There are many ways that things can happen, and I don't always know how they're going to be, but that doesn't mean it's going to be a negative thing. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a bad thing. There are many gifts waiting for all of us, but the key for workaholism, part of the recovery, is letting go, surrendering, and adapting to life and learning to trust that. That's a hard pill to swallow, a bitter pill to swallow. But that's what maybe is we can't know what's going to happen. And so just maybe everything's going to be okay.
Hmm. Later in this chapter, you touch on something which is very difficult for me personally, partly because I think this is something I'm pretty good at. As a matter of fact, I think it comes in handy for the work I do hosting this program, for instance, and that is the matter of multitasking. And and of course, when I'm conducting an interview, in a sense, I have to multitask because I have to listen to you, but at the same time, I need to watch the clock and watch the levels and think about what we've covered and what we haven't and what needs to be explained and so on. So on some level, I must be multitasking here. I can't just listen to you. That's not enough to do the job. But, of course, there is the temptation for people who are pretty good at multitasking to multitask in almost everything that they do all day long, and in a way that can really hurt them. You say, among other things, that studies show, lots of studies show, that multitasking is not what it's cracked up to be, and that, in fact, we are not doing nearly as good a job at whatever the job is at hand when we are doing so in the mode of multitasking. How would you advise a workaholic to break out of this pattern?
Well, I'm going to go back to what you said, because I like the way you laid that out. We all have to multitask sometimes. It's not like you never do it, but if you're a workaholic, it's a pattern, and it's a deadly pattern, and it's also a myth in your mind that the more you can do at one time, the better you're going to be received. And we know that's just not true, and the research shows the opposite to be true. When we focus on one thing at a time, again, the outcome is better, we're more effective, and it's less stressful. But workaholics think that the other piece of it is, if you're multitasking, it gives you that high, because if I have a deadline and if I can write this memo and I can be online and I can be on the phone and I can do these three things at once, it gets your adrenaline going. You feel that rush, and a workaholic will tell you there is nothing like that high. It's very addictive. It feels really good. And you're manic, and you're speeding, and you're hurrying, and you're rushing. Of all the while, it's doing damage to your body. But in the moment, it feels high. The problem is you're not giving your full attention to that one thing. So if this is a pattern over time, workaholics who think that multitask is a good tool to have end up the trajectory of their work is truncated, and it's not as extensive as someone who is moving slower and taking their time and being more methodical.
Towards the end of this first chapter, again titled Fresh Starts, you suggest that the typical workaholic would be well advised to fill their emotional bank. This is really intriguing to me, this notion of thinking of oneself as a bank account. In what way do you think this is helpful for the typical workaholic?
It takes this denial and the nebulous stuff going on in our heads, and it kind of makes it more concrete, and it turns it into a tool. So if I can think of myself as a bank account, I can ask, okay, how many deposits am I making and how many withdrawals am I making? So you can actually write it down on paper. An example of a deposit would be, for me, meditating 5 minutes a day. Or not yelling at the person who cuts me off in traffic, having that as an intention. Withdrawals would be getting upset with the barking dog when I'm in the middle of an interview with you. getting upset with people or with life when things don't go my way. So it just gives you a very concrete and specific way to turn what's nebulous into a working tool, so you can just be more mindful of what's the proportion. And of course, if I'm making more withdrawals, we call this emotional bankruptcy. And if I'm emotionally bankrupt, it's because I'm not making the deposits that I need to make, and it creates obviously all the problems we've been talking about.
Right. It's very interesting to me that you have chosen to pin the focus of this book on this notion of chill and of chilling out, because of course for the typical workaholic that is a completely alien concept. I mean, maybe even a distasteful concept.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
oh, yeah.
and a lot of us, when we think about someone who's just chilling, we picture somebody who's not doing anything at all and just, you know, sitting in an easy chair or a hammock somewhere and sunglasses on and leaving everything behind. And I just find that really intriguing that you are choosing the title of your book and the focus of all that you're sharing here around this concept that a lot of workaholics will not be drawn to at all. Explain why you think this term specifically is the perfect term to use in this case, and how you want workaholics to think of this term, chilling.
Well, a lot of workaholics will hear that as, I need to stop working, and I just need to chill. You're right, because workaholics have something called stinking thinking, and they have a distorted perception of how much they work, and when they hear balance, they hear, oh, okay, I'll have to stop working then, and who's going to pay for my kids' education? That's not what it's about at all. Hard work put us on the moon. What you're doing here is you're bringing chill to, or being is another word for chill, the being to the doing. It's called balance, work-life balance. So the whole idea is for folks to entertain the notion of just 5 minutes a day of some kind of internal prayer, contemplation, meditation, whatever, or taking a walk or a time cushion like you mentioned. What is it you can do to make your life go better that takes 3 to 5 minutes a day? But you're right. Most workaholics, because I've seen it hundreds of times in therapy when people come to me, the first thing they'll say is, don't tell me I have to stop working. But that's the disease. That's the way the mind works. As people start to read through, they start to realize, well, I can do a little bit of that, and things can start to build. I don't know what more to say than that, except that if people who are listening think that, it's all the more reason for them to try it out, because what we always say in therapy is whatever we resist persists, and you can't, if you want to keep walking down the same street, and if it's not working for you, then there needs to be a U-turn. That's what I talk about in the book. A U-turn is trying something different and until you find what does work, what makes you happy, what makes you balanced, what improves your relationships with your family and your loved ones and your friends.
I wanted to finish by talking for a moment about my own life. I really did not want to insert myself into the proceedings here at the outset at all. And I have a fairly unique situation that I don't think is applicable to too many of our listeners, but I am a little curious just to hear what you might have to say. I happen to be somebody who really spends a lot of time working because I have a full-time job teaching at the local college. I have this job at the radio station, and I have another job at my church where I'm the minister of music. So I am spinning a lot of plates in the air, but I love all three of those jobs, and most of the time, none of those jobs feel like work. They feel more like play. They feel more like fun. Not that I'm not working hard, but they are jobs that charge me. They don't deplete me in the way that a lot of jobs can really deplete somebody. That being said, there are probably ways in which I talk myself into believing that, and perhaps somewhere in my being are actually some of these workaholic traits. What would you say for somebody, not necessarily balancing three jobs in their life and spending a lot of time working but really loving it, but even somebody who has a big job that they really, really love but demands a lot of their time, what would your word of advice be for somebody like that? I suspect it would not be that somebody like that has nothing to worry about or has no concerns around this area. In general, what would your advice be for somebody?
That's a great question. Well, there's a difference in being drawn and being driven. And you're describing yourself as being drawn. You love it. You have passion for it. It sounds like it's coming from within you. And I don't hear you saying, I have to, I must, I got to do this. I don't hear pressure. I don't hear stress. There's a difference in being drawn and driven. What I described earlier about my own life, I was driven by external circumstances and my own self-pressures to become inhuman. That's not the same thing. It's not how many hours you work and how many jobs you have. It's what is going on the inside of you as you go through that. And when you're coming from your truth, and when you're living your life based on your inner truth, and what feels right, and when you're feeling drawn, that's a whole different ball game. You know, Michelangelo worked day and night painting the Sistine Chapel. I don't think he was a workaholic. I think it was coming from a passion within him, as opposed to external deadlines or external pressures. So there's a difference in what happens to us physiologically. If I have passion and I'm excited and I can't wait, that's different from the adrenaline and cortisol chemical. I'm going to have endorphins and all kind of other chemicals that are secreting inside me that are making me happy.
That being said, I'm sure you would advise people to really be careful about this and to make sure they're tapping into themselves very honestly.
It's about looking inside objectively and with compassion, not judgment, and taking an honest look at yourself and just say, what are some very small things I can change? And on my website, I have a test that says, how chill are you? And it's free. Folks can go to my website, take the test, and it will give you an immediate electronic score. And there are also blogs from my Psychology Today blog that are free on my website.
Mm. In the meantime, I hope people will seek out your fascinating book, which again is titled Hashtag Chill, Turn Off Your Job and Turn On Your Life, published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. Dr. Brian E. Robinson, I really enjoyed your book and really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. And I hope you will give folks my website so that they can take that test if they want to.
Very good. The website is, let's see, what is that website again?
It's BrianRobinsonBooks.com, B-R-Y-A-N, brianrobinsonbooks.com.
Very good. And thank you again for this conversation.
Thank you, Greg. Bye-bye.
Monday on the morning show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, joins us for his monthly visit to the program, and he will be introducing us to the newest member of the Gateway Board of Trustees. The morning show airs.